Number nine, Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation Plan. This is a briefing. Dave Lowry.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Mr. Director, Mr. Deputy Director. I'm still Dave Lowry of Smelt Briefing fame from a moment ago. And joining me up here is my supervisor, Dr. Tenchi Cho, or Teresa Cho. And today we're going to present to you some information. As you mentioned, this is a briefing, and this was a briefing requested by the Commission essentially on the status of our Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation Recovery Plan and everything that has occurred since the plan went into effect. So, by way of outline, I'll start with some background, talk about the underpinnings of the Puget Sound Rockfish Management Plan, which is the groundfish management plan and the policies. I'll talk about a rockfish assessment that followed up on that, the 2011 Rockfish Conservation Plan, which is really the focus of why we're here, and the ESA listing of three species of rockfish. If you look at this, it looks like they're out of order, 2011, then 10. I'll talk about that in a minute. I'll talk also about some of the priority actions that were identified in this plan and specifically what we've been doing since the plan went into effect. And then I'll really get into kind of the nitty-gritty of the progress of the plan, the implementation of these actions to date, and what we're doing now and where we're heading into the future. So first off, in 1996, the Commission created a policy, C-3003, that recognized that many Puget Sound groundfish stocks were depressed or critical. And from that arose the groundfish management plan a couple of years later in 1998. And essentially, this built on the Commission policy and said that we need to manage these fisheries and these fish resources conservatively. Specifically, it directed the department to develop management plans and conduct stock assessments that should lead to the development of conservation plans. And these conservation plans should really be focused on the long-term viability of these resources and the fisheries and other actions that that interact with them. So in 2009, there was a rockfish biology and assessment report put forward by the department, and it identified a couple of key features of rockfish. Namely that they have shared biology in that they tend to be long-lived, in some cases 100 years or more. They tend to be slow-growing, a couple of centimeters a year for many species would be a pretty quick rate. They're late maturing, potentially into their teens or even later than that. They have high habitat fidelity or site fidelity, so they tend to be found in the same spot, the same individuals year after year after year. And they have what are called periodic recruitment events. So rather than kind of a set, repeating annual cycle of recruitment, rockfish tend to be characterized by having pulsed recruitment that occurs and the juveniles settle out and things go well one year. For the next several years, either the reproductive capacity is not at the proper level or currents blow the larvae offshore or different things like that, and you tend not to have good settlement events. So you tend to have periodic recruitment back to the fishery and back to the resource. This report also identified recent status declines for many of the species. Only 22% of the stocks broken down from these species were identified as healthy, and most of them were either in precautionary or declining status. The report also noted that habitat declines are likely to make these trends worse into the future with nearshore degradation, loss of juvenile habitat, and potentially loss of offshore deeper water habitat for the adults. The plan specifically took recommendations for or made recommendations for how to improve conservation of rockfishes in Puget Sound, and these were broken into several categories. I'll read through these briefly, but essentially the first one is to improve knowledge of ecosystem role and habitat requirements of rockfishes by species and as an aggregate group, to better understand the stressors that are acting on populations of rockfishes, to evaluate the utility of marine reserves as a recovery option for them, to reduce bycatch and account for all catch. So catch from certain fisheries was not being accounted for, and catch in certain areas was not being accounted for at that time. It also recommended that comprehensive surveys were conducted to better estimate the life history parameters of some of these species. As I said, for many of them, we know that they mature late and we know that they get old and grow big, but we don't have the specifics of that. There's a lot of information for the outer coast or for other areas where these species may occur, like Alaska or British Columbia, but within Puget Sound, not all of the necessary data was there. Also, there was a recommendation to better define the stocks using genetics. At the time that the report was written, essentially there was a break between North Sound and South Sound for most of the species, and essentially this was at Port Townsend. So everything south of Admiralty Inlet and down into Central Sound, Hood Canal, and South Sound was considered the South Sound stock, and everything in the North Sound, the San Juan Islands, Georgia Basin, and out the Strait of Juan de Fuca was considered the North Sound stock. So for most species, we simply divided it that way. The plan also recommended the creation of models to reconstruct and analyze the abundance and population structure of these species. So in addition to simply recognizing that many of these stocks or many of these species had abundances that were declining, in 2007, five species were petitioned for ESA listing. And the five species were canary, yellow eye, bocaccio, red stripe, and green striped rockfish. And in 2010, coincident with the writing of this conservation plan and the status assessment, NOAA conducted biological review of these species. And they found that the southern DPS, or the Puget Sound Georgia Basin DPS of these three species, canary and yellow eye, as threatened and bocaccio as endangered, should be listed. The other two, the red stripe and the green striped rockfish, they determined that listing was not warranted at that time. So in 2010, in response, WDFW closed commercial fisheries with either a high encounter rate with rockfishes, so fisheries that were specifically targeted on bottom fishes and rockfishes, and also other fishes that may have had a less high encounter rate, but a high probability of encounter. So some of these floating gillnet, set net fisheries, where there was not necessarily a lot of documentation, but there was certainly the potential for encounter with these species. So that leads us up to 2011, when the Rockfish Conservation Plan was actually finalized and formalized and published. And it had been written in 2009. It was part of the SEPA process, and there were various things going on with revising it. And in 2011, it was finalized. And at that point, it incorporated that 2010 listing for the three species. It is a species group plan, so there was some confusion. There is a Puget Sound rockfish. There was some confusion about whether this was a specific species recovery plan. That's explicitly noted in the plan that this is for all rockfishes in Puget Sound. And the ultimate goal of the plan was to create a comprehensive approach to the assessment and conservation of these species using sound scientific data. So as of late 2010, 2011, essentially the conservation plan was in place. The status assessment identified data gaps and priority actions and clearly defined what could be and should be done. Three species had been listed under the ESA, and as you heard earlier today with respect to Pinto abalone, that brings certain challenges and certain benefits, potentially, depending on the level they're listed at and what take prohibitions are put into place. It also potentially opens up funding opportunities. So at that time, funding and staff time were focused on a couple of actions, and those are really the big things that we're going to talk to you about today. So the first of these was reducing fishery mortality. The second was removing derelict gear and preventing reaccumulation of derelict gear, primarily fishing nets. The third was to determine the distribution abundance and habitat associations of these species on a sound-wide basis. The fourth was to evaluate the effects of these fisheries changes and bycatch estimation. The fifth was to educate and engage the public. And the last was to develop a federal recovery plan for the three species that are ESA listed. So for reducing fishery mortality, as I mentioned earlier, in 2010, all commercial fisheries that were targeted on rockfish or that had a high likelihood of interacting with them were closed down. And those include the otter, beam, and pelagic trawls, and dogfish, set net, and set line fisheries. In 2010, there was also an effort to address the recreational take of rockfish, and it was prohibited in marine areas 6 through 13, which is essentially the area from the eastern portion of the Strait of Juan de Fuca all the way through the rest of Puget Sound, including the San Juans and southern Georgia Basin, as you can see on the map there. As of 2004, there had been a limit of only your first legal rockfish could be caught, and the season had been constrained to May through September. So it was not a year-round fishery. As I said, we had acknowledged for a while that these populations were not doing well. So there had been some progressive curtailment of the fisheries, but in 2010, it was full closure. There was also a prohibition put in place on targeted fishing for groundfish of any species below 120 feet deep. And the goal here was to minimize the barotrauma effects on rockfish that were being brought up from depth and damaged by expanding gas bladders. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment here. So to keep track of exactly how those regulation changes affected rockfish fisheries mortality, we established a GMAP measure, Government Management and Accountability Program measurement, to track this. And essentially, we set a goal of 5,000 pounds. The goal was to try and keep total mortality from all fisheries at or below 5,000 pounds. And this is monitored annually. So I do want to note that the recent changes since 2010 have meant that retention of these fish is illegal. So any retention of these fish where people are reporting that they're keeping them, we don't necessarily always issue tickets, but we certainly make enforcement aware, and you know, there's a good talking to. But that there is significant bycatch, especially in halibut and other fisheries where they are fishing on the bottom or near the bottom for any ground fish or salmon species. So over the last few years, you can see in the figure here that in the early 80s and 90s, there was substantial catch in the range of the high 400,000s of pounds, and that had dropped off substantially by 2003 and 4 when we had these more focused recreational trimmings and cutting back of the commercial harvest. If you look at 2010 through 13, which is kind of highlighted in that inset figure there, you can see that we've been pretty close to the 5,000-pound goal over the last several years. And in 2013, we ended at 5,143 pounds, which statistically is indistinguishable from meeting our goal. So we feel like that's been fairly successful. So the next major issue that we were trying to deal with and that was recommended by the plan was to address derelict fishing nets. And this has involved a very strong and progressive partnership with the Northwest Drake Foundation and Natural Resource Consultants. And to date, over 4,000 derelict nets have been removed. Most of these are gill nets or fragments of gill nets that have been recovered off the bottom. There have also been a few purse seines and other things like that, but it's predominantly gill nets. And at last estimate, it was estimated that the removal of these nets had restored 668 acres of benthic habitat. So physically picking these nets up off the bottom provides access for these fish to the crevices and the niches that they need to be able to avoid predators, for the juveniles to flourish, things like that. Also, as a portion of this, it was implementation of the Senate Bill 5661, and several WACs were put into place that require the reporting of lost nets, and specifically the reporting of lost nets in 24 hours. So the efforts up to this point had been about getting out these so-called legacy nets, nets that have been there for a while. And implementation of this rule, or this Senate bill, allowed rapid reporting, response, and retrieval of nets that have been lost. So any gillnet fisheries that are ongoing, salmon gillnet fisheries for the most part, the fisher or anyone else can call in the location of a net, and there's basically a boat standing by that's ready to go out and get it, whether it stays afloat or whether it sinks. Additional funding was provided in 2014 through a Section 6 grant. So again, because of this ESA nexus of the ESA-listed species, we managed to get some money to deal with this. And there's been extensive outreach to both state and tribal fishers about loss of nets and the impacts of these loss to rockfishes and other bottom fishes. And in 2014, the legislature saw fit to designate $3.5 million to basically finish the job. Essentially, Northwest Straits Foundation and the Natural Resource Consultants folks that were working on this have documented a lot of these nets, but have not had the time and the money to go back and actually pull them out. So what this money functionally does is allow us to finish cleaning up all of the known legacy nets in shallow water in Puget Sound. There are some deep water nets that we're trying to address, but funding was not awarded for that this coming year. We are doing a pilot removal effort, though, to go after some of these deeper nets that are beyond diveable depths using an ROV, which you'll hear about extensively in a minute here. So the next major thing that was recommended and that we sought to address was getting better abundance estimates for rockfish on a Puget Sound-wide basis. So in 2008 and 2010, we conducted some pilot studies in the San Juan Islands. And in 2012, we went whole hog and decided that we were going to estimate abundance for the entire Puget Sound in one fell swoop. So in addition to abundance estimates, using these survey points that you can see on the map here, we could also document the distribution of different species, and we could document specifically which habitats these species were associated with. Now, at first, that seems silly because they're called rockfish, so of course we're going to find them on rock, right? Well, not necessarily. And in fact, we found out for some species that's really only part of the story. So what we did was put together a design from a tool called Stereology, and essentially what this does is overlays a fixed grid of sample points on the area that you'd like to sample and starts with a randomized point so that any place in Puget Sound has the same probability of being selected as a survey site. It does not stratify based on habitat, so we were not just looking at rock. We were looking at all substrates throughout Puget Sound. And we surveyed from April of 2012 through April of 2013. And at each of the points that you see on the map here, we conducted one-hour video transects. So the remotely operated vehicle that you see in the inset photo there is the ROV Yellow Eye, which is our tool for conducting these surveys. And the goal was to take this out with the 36-foot vessel, drop it down to wherever the bottom may be, and for one solid hour, proceed at a reasonable pace across the bottom, counting fish, documenting habitat. The coloration of the dots, and I'm not sure how well that comes across on the screen here, but red dots are stations that we were unable to hit during that one-year period. Green triangles are places that we hit during daylight hours. Pink are places that we hit in the wee hours of the morning, and the blue ones are the ones that my crew hates me for because we hit them between midnight and 8 a.m. So yes, we really truly went nocturnal for several weeks and just hit these so that we could try and get full coverage of when these fish were out and where they were during different times of day. So I want to focus on a couple of things here. One, while we were looking at rockfish with this and while this was recommended by the rockfish plan, because we were surveying all of the habitats, we were looking at multiple species. So we were focusing on rockfish and flatfish because of their historic and current fisheries importance. But we were also counting other things because while we're there and while we've got the video, why not? It's part of ecosystem management. You need to know about all of the things that are out there. So we were counting crab, fish, sea cucumbers, urchins, a variety of other things. And that information has been shared with other units within WDFW and with several collaborators at this point. So for the first time ever, what this abundance estimate allows us to do is generate species occurrence maps from systematically sampled data, which is something we've not had from the past. Fisheries data is notoriously biased towards the place where the fishermen go, whether that's where the fish are or not. It also allows us to generate abundance estimates with error estimates for the entire sound. So we have some estimate of how good our data really are. It also allows us to statistically evaluate the biodiversity patterns that we're seeing. So we're using a software called Primer, or Primer E, to look at differences in biodiversity patterns throughout the sound. It also allows us to look at species-specific habitat associations. So again, where are these fish found? Is it just over rock? Is it over just certain kinds of rock? Is it in association with rock, regardless of whether it's in big piles or out in the middle of a mud flat? And we were able to do this on both a macro and a micro scale. So over the course of that one-hour sample we took at each location, we looked at the primary habitat type. But then every time we encountered one of our focal species, one of these rockfish or flatfish species, we would also record this specific habitat they were sitting on. So a rock in the middle of a mud flat is different from a rock in a pile of rocks. And you can clearly see that from the data. Ultimately, this will inform the design of future ROV work that we plan to do. The ROV is being relied upon here as opposed to something like a bottom trawl because benthic trawling can only occur on mud. It can't really occur on areas with high relief rock because you snag up the net, you tear them off, and then we have to go get them using other money. So rather than doing that, we're trying to use this visual technique to really get into the high relief rock. It may be combined with our trawl data and other information in the future, and we're still working out exactly how that goes. As I said, the video portion of this was done in April of 2013, the field portion, the data collection. Since then, we've been reviewing the videos. So it's taken us just over a year now to complete video review. So because I've been talking for a while and because I've been talking about ROVs and they're exciting because they shoot video, I thought I'd show you an image of what we see out there. And this is an example of a location. We're in about 75 feet of water, and this is off Whale Rocks in the south side of the San Juan Islands. And in this video, you can see some of the rockfish that we're talking about. To the right there's a quillback rockfish, and we'll center up and fly straight in just a minute here. There's also several kelp greenling. You can see that this is a really good rocky habitat. Lots of plumose anemones all over the place. Ling cod makes an appearance here in a minute. Kelp greenlings. So these are the kinds of things that we were looking for, looking at, counting. The lasers in the middle there are 10 centimeters or about 4 inches apart. And those were used to measure the width of the screen that we were viewing, as well as the size of the fish that we encountered. So there's a quillback rockfish there. And as you can see, there are urchins, there are a variety of other things out there that we can count and quantify and look at. So ultimately, we set this grid on Puget Sound. We had determined that we were looking at 215 stations, and we were able to sample 197 of them. Most of the ones that we missed were up near the Canadian border. Essentially, during the weeks that we had tried to work up there, we got blown off the water and just couldn't work out a plane. But we completed 197 stations, and initial video review is now complete for all of those. We're doing a 10% secondary review, and this is for quality assurance and quality control. We're going back and rereading some of these tapes with different reviewers to really make sure that the data we're getting is sound. The depth surveyed ranged from 8 meters, or about 25 feet, down to 245 meters, or in excess of 700 feet. So we really truly covered the scope and range of Puget Sound. More than 50% of the sites were dominated by mud, and we only had 15% over hard substrate. So that video I showed you is a little bit misleading. If those were the videos that our reviewers were watching all the time, they would love me more than they do now. But we did see a lot of mud and a lot of soft substrate. We also saw a lot of biocover and different kinds of biocover. So earlier, Bob Sizemore mentioned that pinto abalone, like that red encrusting algae, and you saw some of that in the video. We also saw tube worms, sponges, sea pens, plumose anemones, a variety of different things. We were able to identify 55 species, and I say species in quote there because in some cases we can identify things down to maybe a family level or a couple of species that really the only way to differentiate them is to have the specimen in hand. So we got down to some of them. We have things like juvenile gadids. So it may be a pollock, it may be a cod, but it's about 4 inches long. It definitely has the right body configuration, but it's too far away to really pick out the details that we need. Also, substantial marine debris was identified, including nets, bottles, cans, tires, all kinds of other things, and cataloged. And in collaboration with the work I talked about earlier, anywhere that we identified a net, we went back and we coordinated to go retrieve that net. The encounter rate, unfortunately, for the ESA-listed species that we were looking for was very low, and so the estimates that we produced for them, as you'll see in a minute, are not really sound. So I've got preliminary stamped on these estimates. They are preliminary because I literally finished them yesterday, and we've not got any additional analysis done here. But the thing that I really want to point out here is that these are the first estimates we've ever produced for these rockfish species on a Puget Sound-wide basis, where not only can we generate an abundance estimate based on systematic sample data, but we can also tell you how good that estimate is, or bad. So the coefficient of variation there, the higher that is, the less confidence we have in that estimate. So you'll see for some of these species, like Pacific Ocean Perch, we observed a single individual. So when you expand that to the given area and everything, it says we may have as many as almost 11,000 fish out there, but it also says we have no faith whatsoever in that estimate. For the species that we encountered on a more regular basis over different habitat types and ones that we saw quite a few of, like quillback rockfish in the middle there, we're estimating just over 3.5 million fish sound-wide, and we're under the 25% CV goal that we had originally set for this. We are producing those distribution maps that I talked about and a variety of other things for this, the assessment of biodiversity by station, patterns in biodiversity across the sound, but we just got the data in, so we're working hard on producing those. And the plan right now is to produce a report by the end of the summer or early into the fall. So now I'll turn the microphone over to Teresa here, and she'll talk about another major research effort.
So in 2011 and 2012, marine fish science staff, we conducted a special study project in marine area 4B. Our marine area 4B is a little area just by the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So it is a transition area from open ocean condition into Puget Sound. And the rules that implemented in the area is also transitional. It's very different from the coastal rules or the Puget Sound rule. So we established a project to evaluate if the rules implemented in that area are effective in protecting rockfish, in reducing mortality that associate with fishing. And also because we close the retentions of most of the rockfish in that area, it's important to evaluate if the release information that collected by the dockside samplers, if those are accurate and suitable for management use. And so the first project started in July 2011, that we did a 2 months of pilot project to set up the research method and platform. And in 2012, we conducted a full fishing season from April to September. Next slide. So the new rules implemented for Area 4B, before 2010, the aggregate bag limit for ground fish are 15 per day, and rockfish, no matter what species, it's 10 per day. In 2010 and 11, the aggregate bag limit is still 15, but we put some restrictions on the rockfish. They only can retain 6 blue or black in combined, and the deep air water was close to fishing. In 2011 and 12 fishing season, we reduced the aggregate bag limit to 10. This is to reduce the encounter rate. So they can still only retain 6 blue and black by reducing other groundfish species that will reduce the release the mortality. The bottom figures show you the fishing effort since 2013. We use this fishing, the fishing effort and the catch information from 2003 to 2008 as the base to calculate the potential protection we can provide, establish the rules. So I'd like you to remember this pattern, because when we estimate mortality, it's not only the regulations that are affected, the estimates, but also how many people are out there fishing, also affecting the release mortality. Okay, next one. This is, in summary, that my left-hand panel is for blue and black rockfish, total mortality. Total mortality include the fish that are landed, brought back to the dock, so it's dead for sure, and also there are the reported by angler that released. So we, based on where they're caught, we estimate a certain portion of those released fish were dead, and another portion that survived. So the total mortality include the actual dead fish and the released mortality. And from 2003 to 2008, the blue bar, that was the average of the total mortality for blue and black. We, there's no line above 2009, because that was the year we conducted our analysis. So in 2009, we estimated if we established a new rule, we're expecting to see about 25% of reduction in black and blue mortality. And so in 2010 and 2013, that's the average, that's the goal of 25% reduction from the first blue line. As you can see, those years other than 2010, a little bit above that goal, we are below our goal. And so the actual on average for the recent 4 years is about 30% reduction. And the right-hand side is all other rockfish other than blue and black. It's the same thing. The left-hand side from 3 and 8, that was the average of the those years, and the right-hand side, that bar, was our goal. And so because there are so many species in that other category, so we anticipate about 60 to 80% of reductions. And in average, that we achieve the 61% reduction for all other rockfish species. So we see that the regulation is actually quite effective in reaching our goal. On evaluating the release information, we conducted a test fishery, which we sent out our staff and fishing, actually go fishing on the water. We separate their seven sub-areas, so each area they'll go out day by day fishing on the water using the fishing method that we think most match what the recreation angler will use. And this is the fish species composition of rockfish that from the test fisheries on the right-hand side. And OSP is our dockside sampling program. It's reported by the anglers. As you can see, we capture all the species. The species themselves are the same, but the composition of that in the pie is very different from the test fisheries and what angler reported. So in conclusion, that so we know the regulations are effective, not based on the information we collected. But we think that the anglers, it's very challenging for them to identify the rockfish species. As you can see from the handout that was passed out, that they all look very similar. We did a quick dockside interview. Most of them can tell from red or black. So we at the end, towards the end of study, we pass out the identification card at the bait shop or at the dock for the anglers to take with them to help them ID the released fish, and also they can write the number of fish that released on their fishing trip to, so they can report back to us the more accurate number of fish being released.
And that handout is also actually available from the webpage, so people can print it out and take it to the field with them, so they don't necessarily just need to pick it up at the tackle shop. So in addition to these research efforts and these fishery evaluations that we've been doing, we've also done a lot with education and outreach. One of those things is an advocacy program for descending devices. These are, generally speaking, hooks or boxes or bins that you can attach to a fish to send it back down to the depth from which you caught it. And WDFW has been involved with this. I know that the commission has received a briefing on this from Heather Reed and from Ron Garner from the Puget Sound Anglers. But the WDFW, as part of that, has been to create the Protect Washington's Rockfish brochure and several posters that have been distributed. There have also been substantial updates to the department's webpage, descending device page, as well as linkages to some videos on YouTube, including a rap video about bringing your rockfish down, all kinds of creative methods for getting the word out. There have also been several presentations and demonstrations of how to use these devices at coastal charter offices, at various fishing groups, and kind of recreational clubs, the Puyallup Sportsman Show, and at Nia Bay and the Push during the halibut and lingcod openers. So rockfish are often bycaught species associated with these fisheries. It's great for these folks to know how to use them, and it's a good place to actually get contact with the individuals. On the Puget Sound Anglers side of that, they've developed the Save Our Fisheries handout. They've also purchased and distributed hundreds of free descending devices. Some of these devices can be on the order of tens to $30, $40, $50. Some of them are very inexpensive and essentially are just an inverted hook that you put through the lip of the fish to drop it down and then shake it off at depth. So they've found a few of these devices that they can distribute pretty well that people have good luck with and are willing to use. They've also independently presented some information and demonstrations on how to use these devices at the Seattle Boat Show, and they were with the department at the Puyallup Boat Show or Sportsman Show. In addition to these efforts, kind of focused on descending devices, we've also done some pretty substantial things with our webpage. So in 2013, we renovated the department's webpage. Bottom fish ID guide that had been on the webpage was removed in 2009 when we went through a pretty big renovation of the website as a whole, not just for marine fish, but the entire department website. And somehow it just never made it back to the web. So it literally had been pulled down in 2009 and not put back. So we renovated it with a lot of new photos, new information, better descriptions, clearer descriptions, lots of information on rockfish recovery efforts. And we also have staff and project profile pages. So if you go now onto the webpage, there are links to the Soundwide ROV project that we talked about, the Area 4B evaluation, various things like that. And it also explicitly links names and email addresses to that so that people can get in touch with us much easier. We also attended something called the Discover Science Days up at the Seattle Aquarium, and we brought the ROV with us. So we literally had the ROV in there so that people could see what it was, they could watch some of the videos, they could put hands on this tool and really make a connection. And this year, the event was bigger than it's been in any other year. So over a two-day period, we couldn't work the holiday, so we were there the 9th and 10th. But over a two-day period, we encountered over 4,000 people, direct contact with them, and talked about the projects that we do. We've also done a variety of presentations, kind of focus presentations at scuba clubs and other local organizations about rockfish conservation. And we've also created a volunteer logbook for recreational anglers. That's also, I think Tammy's got that back there. And this is a packet that can be handed out to recreational anglers. This is nothing mandatory at this point, but it's just trying to help us get some information from people that are willing to share their data. And basically, it consists of a log so that people can keep track of where they're fishing and what they're catching and when they're catching it. They can record all kinds of things about the weather and other details like that. It also comes with some rockfish identification photos and things like that to help them with their species ID. And these are being distributed mostly at this point in the Nea Bay area and kind of that Area 4B, but we have plans to move that into the rest of Puget Sound.
I'd like to just add to that. So for the anglers to participate in this program, they need to go through a training project in rockfish ID. So I want to make sure the information they record on there is adequate. And then you're welcome to open the package to see what's in there.
All right. So in addition to these education and outreach efforts, we also have an ESA-listed rockfish recovery team. So for the three species that have been listed, canary, yellow eye, and Bokashio, the federal government, NOAA, convened a team. And essentially, the goal of this group is to put together a formal plan on the federal level that makes recommendations on what can be done. And the critical aspect of this, in addition to the plan that we've got, is that because it's a federal plan, it directly links to a lot of opportunities for funding or recommendations for funding pools that might be available for this kind of work. The members of this panel include state government, federal government, and academics. So it's all kinds of people from various different walks of life that deal with rockfish population dynamics and distribution and studies of these species. Right now, myself and Mr. Robert Pakunski from our Region 4 office in Mill Creek represent WDFW. For the most part, we're both there, but essentially we at least try to tag team so that one of us is at every meeting. The meetings began in the spring of 2013, and they'll occur until September of 2014 when the plan's hopefully going to be available for peer review. It'll go internal within NOAA first and then externally for a peer review period before being hopefully accepted. An interesting thing here and a really important part of why we're playing and interacting with the federal government on this is that the plan draws a lot of information directly from the conservation plan that we already have in place. Now, the listing is the Puget Sound, Georgia Basin distinct population segment, so information has to be pulled from Canada and from other places to really evaluate the abundance and the diversity of these species. We are collaborating with some Canadians on this, but because it's a federal plan, because it's limited to U.S. waters, most of the information is coming from us, from WDFW. So that sounds like a lot. We've covered a lot of ground already today, and I hope you're duly impressed with how much work we've been doing here, but that's really only scratching the surface. There are a lot of other things that were recommended, if not explicitly, at least something that kind of keys off of a recommendation from the plan. And so we've been doing some other things, like putting acoustic tags out in canary rockfish in the San Juan Islands. So these questions about where these fish go, how many they are, how broadly distributed they are, how much site fidelity there is, we're trying to address these. We also have genetic samples that are being collected for the listed species on a soundwide basis and that have been collected for other species wherever they're encountered in other surveys. And we're collaborating with the Salmon Test Fishery Group on this. NOAA Fisheries is doing a specific project for this. We have several people at the Friday Harbor Lab from University of Washington that are collecting samples when and where they encounter them. We're also tagging and doing collection of gut contents from rockfish during our SoundWide ROV surveys. So every May, we go out and do benthic trawl surveys. These do catch rockfish. They're really focused on the soft bottom species. But like I said, there are some species like quillback rockfish that appear to be everywhere. They're over any and every kind of habitat you can think they might be on. And so we've been collecting some of those during the trawl survey. We've also been doing targeted ROV inspections, so in addition to trying to cover literally the entire Puget Sound with the ROV, we've also gone to some very specific locations where NOAA has identified critical habitat for the ESA-listed species, and we've dropped down and looked specifically at these areas to see if we can find them in these locations that we think they've been in the past. We have documentation that they've been there, and we believe that they may be there now. So we've been kind of spot-checking those, and we're recently awarded a grant to go do more of that work. We're also collaborating with the Northwest Straits Foundation to monitor removal of derelict nets and maintain that reporting hotline that I talked about earlier. As I said, they received several million dollars, $3.5 million this year, and that's to essentially remove all of the rest of the shallow water nets. We're also going after some of the deep water nets, some pilot work there, and collaborating with them on just documentation of and kind of keeping up with removal of these nets. So in conclusion, there was identified prior to this plan that several species of Puget Sound rockfish had exhibited long-term declines in abundance. The conservation plan clearly organizes some actions, makes some recommendations, and tries to address the major threats that are known for these species. And substantial progress has been made addressing many of these things, addressing data gaps with some of the research, addressing education and outreach and angler identification, things like that. The plan implementation thus far is certainly improving our management. As I said, we've got abundance estimates for these species, which we've never had on a SoundWide basis. We also have habitat and distribution information that we've never had. We know more about the ability of anglers to identify them and the composition of the bycatch in some of these very specific focal areas. We are seeing positive signs in abundance for some species. Some of this is from our research. Some of this is anecdotal, but there are some species like blacks and yellowtails that we keep getting recreational reports that they're absolutely everywhere. And when we go out and try and validate some of these, we do find more fish in some of these areas than we would have expected. So there are some positive signs. Unfortunately, thus far, these are mostly for the species that are shorter lived and faster maturing than a lot of the other species. So not necessarily the ESA listed species. And kind of a final conclusion is that restoration really is a long-term complex task that involves a lot of partners. We certainly can't do this alone, and we've mentioned several of our partners throughout this presentation. The long-term, as I said, some of these fish live to be over 100 years old, and if we think we're going to recover them in the next 5 years, that's just not realistic. But progress is being made. We're getting there, and this is a long-term commitment that we're prepared to stand behind. So with that, oh, wait, we have more stuff.
Oh.
What are we still doing? What are we doing next? So we're continuing to do the abundance and distribution surveys. The plan right now, at least preliminarily, is to do one of these SoundWide surveys every 5 years. Every time I tell my staff that, they all threaten to retire. We're doing expanded scuba surveys for young of the year fish. There was a time period in which we were really looking for young of the year and juveniles in the shallow waters. And over the last couple of years, we've lacked the capacity. We haven't had enough scuba divers on staff. So we're getting back. We've staffed up and we're getting back to doing that. We also have this volunteer angler logbook program that we pass the logbook around for. And we're expanding that, trying to move that more into Puget Sound. Lots of education and outreach efforts, species ID guides, the web page, all of these other things, and descending devices, and just really trying to promote that and keep that going. We also have these site-specific surveys to evaluate the designated critical habitat. As I mentioned before, we've done this a little bit, kind of spot-checking here and there. We recently received a grant and are talking about a study designed to really go out and systematically survey some of these areas. One of the places that they're most concerned with is Hood Canal, so we're planning to spend some time there potentially in the next year or two. And also completion of the federal recovery plan. As I said, we hope to have this done, formalized and out for review sometime in late summer or early fall. And I believe the person who's kind of heading this up, her appointment ends at the end of September. So we're hoping to have it all done, wrapped up in a bow on it by then. So with that,
okay.
I'll take any questions that you have.
Very good. Any questions? You did pack that full of information, didn't you?
I'm sorry about that.
It was really good.
In the afternoon, but
excellent work. Very interesting. Okay, everyone, learn your identification chart here. It's good. I'm glad that you're putting that much emphasis on the website and outreach and working with partners. So thanks very much.